Let's talk. Talk. Giles Brown. You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Mafia takedown is this true story of FBI agent Mike Campi, who led some of the most relentless and successful attacks on organized crime in American history. It's a real eye-opener of a book. I'm delighted to say that Mike joins me live now. Mike, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good afternoon.
Good to have
you. Nice speaking with you.
Good to have you with us. Let's kick off with how... So your FBI, how do you join the FBI and what sort of spurs you on?
Well, I mean, you can just go online for the application process, but to become an FBI agent as opposed to a support staff person, there's certain requirements. You have to have a college degree. It's competitive. I mean, at the time frame when I was coming into the Bureau, the FBI, they were looking for accountants and attorneys. As you can imagine, it also had an interest in people that could speak Russian, other languages. I would imagine now your AI technique would be an enhancement. And typically you have to have some work experience too as a category. And then they test you. There's a written test. And based on how you do in the written test, it'll provide an opportunity for then an interview as part of the test score, and both get combined. You get placed on a list, and the list evolves and changes regularly. So when I came in and as an agent, it was in 1983, they were running new agent training classes every 2 weeks. You had 50 people in a class, and it was approximately 16 weeks of training. So a lot of people, some people didn't make it through, you know, for whether it was the written test, the firearms or physical, the PT side. So it was a process. I enjoyed it.
So you got through. Now, a lot of us, because most of us on this side of the pond only kind of know the FBI through, I don't know, Hollywood movies. They've seen Elliot Ness, hard bitten, hard drinking, you know, doing a lot of leather work, etc. That's the sort of image we get. And when you mention organized crime, I have this thing with organized crime, because since The Sopranos, it kind of became cool. And it became, you got this whole honor amongst thieves and the mythology. But when you actually have the quote-unquote pleasure of sitting down with people who live on the other side, they're not as pleasant and as lovable as perhaps Hollywood and the TV writers make out.
Yeah, I am not... I don't usually watch a lot of law enforcement shows. And I remember, you know, towards the end of my career, and I used to testify as the expert on organized crime, The Sopranos last series, TV series, I think, was coming up, and they'd asked if I'd participate in an interview about it. And I said, well, I don't really watch The Sopranos, and they gave me a season to watch. As I, you know, I had a TV up in the bedroom, and I would sort of just turn it on, and I'm looking at the storyline, and I'd roll over and go to sleep. The wife, who did not like to hear about my work, was fascinated and would watch it. She wanted me to get seasons. But a lot of the stories are based on, you know, stories that actually exist, some of the stories. And that's one of the things that jumped out at me. I was, you know, watching and saying, well, this is actually something that occurred. That's what I found interesting. I thought the crew in The Sopranos was sort of more like a broken down crew of what I would describe as knuckleheads. But in the book, I actually made recordings with Patty Falsetti. He had a relative that was, you know, part of the show. And it's the type of thing where Hollywood sensationalized certain aspects, you know, of the mob, when and I made numerous recordings about how dysfunctional, treacherous, and backstabbing it is. I mean, when you just think of it, having four or five good friends that you really could trust with your life, I mean, that's rare. You're joining an organization of criminals where, say, a small organized crime family in New York may have 100 guys, 120 guys, and each guy has at least 10, if they're worth anything, at least 10 close associates, and you're going to trust them with your life? I mean, I cite in the book the three words you want to run away from is "I love you," because it's just totally not true. It's just a con. And there's treachery there, and there's envy. There's a lot of envy, which, you know, jumps out at me, where you get somebody, you know, that talks about how much he hates this other guy and his family. And it's either from teasing, a lot are short, you know, like Sammy the Bull, I think, comes up to my chin. So there's something about that. It's not going to be a fist fight so much as a shoot you in the back of the head.
I love the fact that the words "I love you" are dangerous, because we're recording, listeners, we're recording this on Valentine's Day. So if you are listening, that's particularly outstanding. I know a little about the history of the mob at this point, and it's a really sort of, the 80s is a really interesting time for it, because it's gone through that sort of Vegas, glamorous, Sinatra, whatever, sort of Godfather type thing of the 50s and 60s. The 70s, the drugs come in, and that changes a lot of perspectives. And in the 80s, you've got, and I can't remember his name, but you've got the slaying in 1980 of the mob boss who's having dinner. Those pictures went all around the world, having lunch in his Italian restaurant. Was it Big? Wasn't Big Paul? And then you got the slaying of, is it Big John? Big Paul in 19...
Paul Castellano.
Yeah.
Yeah, by John Gotti.
Yes.
And in that, that was not a murder of a boss. Historically going back, is supposed to be authorized by the commission. The commission consisted of, say, the bosses of the five New York families, in addition to the boss of Philadelphia family and the boss of Chicago. What they did, killing Paul Castellano, flew in the face of a sanctioned murder. And so Gotti, basically, and others, Sammy the Bull, set themselves up to eventually be murdered. What was going on at that time, and there was, you know, plans to murder them, was there were a lot of guys cooperating as a result of what was occurring after that fact. And it became the type of thing where Gotti was a focus because of his big ego and his arrogance, that everybody in law enforcement is looking, okay, let me focus on this guy who killed the boss of a family. And so there were surveillances that I spoke with some friends that were, my squad was different. That was the Gambino squad, but they would laugh because they'd see Gotti looking at cars that were passing by as though they were the surveillance cars, when meanwhile other cars were out there parked in a very stationary manner, you know, filming what was going on. If there was any indication of dysfunction and treachery and hypocrisy, it was Gotti with that murder. I mean, you don't like your boss, you know, quit, leave, go to Florida, go leave or something like that. But whacking him is sort of stepping over their rules and jeopardizing not only your life, but your family's life. I mean, John Jr., his son, became a boss. Peter, the brother, you know, it just sort of seemed like that was not the right step to make. And there were other people in the family that were much more skilled and knowledgeable than John as far as running an organization.
Mm. But I mean, that just, he was just this disruptor. And, you know, and this egotist, and it must have sent shivers down the established order, because there is an order to these things. It has to be. Otherwise, it becomes a free-for-all.
Well, he loved being in the news. He loved being in the media. And he loved the attention. While I think the brighter bosses and people in organized crime have a low-key standard. Mm. You know, they don't want to be out there in a profile type of Hollywood topic.
King of New York and all that. Tell me about the Gambino family, because that was who you were working with.
No, mine was the Genovese family. The Genovese family. perfect example.
Have we got five families? Are these the five families that people mythologize? You know,
so in New York, it evolved, but you have the, say, the Genovese family, which is viewed as the most sophisticated, secretive family. You have the Gambino family, which was the Paul Castellano, John Gotti. You had the Colombo family. You had the Lucchese family. And you had the Bonanno family. And so those were the five New York-based families. They evolved from back in the days of Lucky Luciano. The original Genovese family was the Luciano family. The original Gambino family was called the Mangano family. So there's a lot. I think the only family, Bonanno family, was original. Joe Bonanno was a young boss back in the day. And they maintained that name, even though he got thrown out because of his treachery and hypocrisy, trying to coordinate the murder of a boss with an individual who was the boss of the Colombo family, which back in the day, the Colombo family was called the Provaci family. Joe Provaci was the boss. So that was the original boss. So there's a lot there, but Cingiganti, was the boss of the Genovese family. And he was a guy that lived in the village section, the West Village, and he'd walk around in a bathrobe like he was crazy to avoid the law enforcement scrutiny. He was historically a pro boxer. He was under Vito Genovese, who was the boss. He was well liked. Cingiganti was feared, you know, as boss. He was an individual that participated in the shooting of Frank Costello. Frank Costello was part of Vito Genovese, a Lucky Luciano going back historically. He became the acting boss when Lucky Luciano went to prison after Vito Genovese fled to Italy to avoid a murder. This is back in the 30s, 40s. So Frank Costello was conspiring, and it's in the book, with Albert Anastasia to kill Vito Genovese. And they met with the consigliere for the Genovese family, Michael Miranda. And the reason they wanted to kill Vito Genovese, and here's your I love you type of statement, it was Lucky Luciano went to prison back in 1936. He was convicted of operating these prostitution rings, and he got a 40-year sentence. Who became the acting boss was Vito Genovese. And a year later, Vito Genovese flees to Italy because of a murder he committed and to avoid being arrested. Who then becomes the acting boss is Frank Costello. You fast forward after World War II, when Vito Genovese, apparently the witness on the murder, gets killed. Vito returns to the States, and the two guys are bumping heads as far as who's really running the show for Lucky. And that eventually facilitates this meeting, like in 1957, where Albert Anastasia, you know, who had previously murdered his boss to elevate himself to boss, it's amazing, you know, the bizarre nature of it all. They meet with Michael Miranda, the consigliere, who's well liked by Frank Costello, Albert Anastasia, and they want to get his feedback on killing Vito Genovese. And Michael, being, I guess, a shrewd guy, says, well, let me think about it for a day or two, and I'll circle back to you. And he immediately goes to Vito to tell Vito, they're going to kill you. I just had this meeting. And that was, and this was a cooperator telling me these details. I don't think they've ever been provided in any historical sense before, but George Perrone was a Genovese soldier. He was a Genovese person around Vito Genovese at that time. And he cooperated with me on my investigation decades later. So George described how when Michael Miranda went to Vito, they asked Vito, was there any other witnesses there from a family? And they cited John Sonny Francis, a historic member of the Colombo family, or back then it was called the Provaci family. He was in the same restaurant, and he corroborated the meeting between Miranda, Albert Anastasia, and Frank Costello. Vito assigned Frank Costello's murder to Vincent Gigante. And Gigante shot Costello in the head, but he didn't die, which amazed me because it was in a vestibule of a building. You would think if you're doing the murder, you'd step in and maybe use a few more rounds.
Yeah.
But as I understood from Barone, Costello corroborated the conspiracy to murder Vito. And they then said, don't let Albert know, Anastasia. And they facilitated, you know, the shooting. So Albert was unaware that Costello was shot because of this conspiracy. And they ended up killing Albert Anastasia at the barbershop just a few months later. And then right after that, it facilitated the historic meeting in upstate New York called the Appalachia meeting.
Now this meeting, because the official story says that it's a lucky break that the authorities get because a trooper drives by and sees all these out-of-state plates on the back of the car or something like that.
Yeah, it is comical when you think about it. So they knew they had a guy, I guess, a criminal in their midst. But if you can imagine being in the outskirts of the country in, say, Ireland or England, and you see all these cars lined up coming in, you've got some of the people staying at a local hotel, and it's just an enormous group. The state police, you know, put together an operation to sort of catch as many as they could. They were fleeing through fields. If you could picture guys in suits, field, you know, the whole fleeing part. So there was a bunch of them captured. It must have been, you know, a nice night at the bar there for the state troopers that were on this because it was entertaining. But that's what brought to the attention, I want to say, of J. Edgar Hoover, that, yeah, there is a national organization because these guys were from all over the country coming in. Like, that was another thing. Joe Bonanno and his brother Salvador Bonanno owned a hotel opposite Newark Airport. And from my understanding, a bunch of people from the organized crime families located that flew in stayed at that hotel before they drove upstate to that meeting in Appalachian. So it was, yeah, it was something you couldn't ignore.
And
that sort of evolved.
And presumably with Hoover in charge, I mean, obviously he has this reputation, but he kept files and everything. And, you know, I'm not excusing, but he loved his country. He was to the degree of paranoia, but, he, you know, he apparently his record keeping, his file keeping were quite outstanding. That is one of the reasons why, you know, he could keep all these tabs on everybody.
Yeah. And I remember before computers, they just had everything on these index cards in an alphabetized manner that would reference you to where files were, that you could review them to determine what information and intelligence existed on whatever topic you were looking to, you know, review. So, yes, he was that way. And it was the type of thing where my father being Italian, my mother being Irish, I mean, that was a topic of conversation, of Sunday dinners. They used to drive me wild about his talking about, you know, the mob, political corruption, corruption in the church, and then vitamins. God knows how vitamins made its way into these topics.
So when you by the 80s, when you're getting involved, what are we talking about in terms of the organized crime? I mean, are we talking sort of still, you know, running clubs, prostitution, racketeering, or has it sort of grown and taken in, you know, the brave new world?
Well, I think, you know, any way they can make money. It's one of the things that is fascinating about how they run into opportunities. It's not just their own genius. A lot of it may stem from, say, for instance, you got guys from Wall Street who are big gamblers and end up losing, you know, whether it's sports or some other capacity, they may design some kind of penny stock scheme for them to bang out millions of dollars. I mean, that was one of the things I discussed in the book, that there was a corrupt check cashing facility in Jersey City, which is right next to New York City, Manhattan. And this individual, in the recordings we made, they were talking about how they were able to bang like over tens of millions of dollars in penny stocks through this check cashing facility. So they'd have people opening up a check cashing account under a fictitious name, fictitious photo, and they'd never be in camera because they'd let them in the back door to bang out the checks. So we created a scenario with my cooperating witness, Michael Durso, to create what was an appearance of a corrupt individual at a huge corporation who's been stealing millions for years. And so we wanted to give him a check to basically catch and identify that corrupt scheme with this individual that they cited nobody can meet him because he was such a valuable associate to the family. And his name was Robert Santoro. And we created a meeting, provided the scheme, provided a check that was backstopped by FBI money. And I remember arresting him. It was a funny day. He had a toupee on and is describing how his wife has never seen him without the toupee. And I said, well, I think if she visits you in prison, she's going to see you.
What's it like when you get a recording or you get a piece of video VHS tape, kids ask your parents, and you know that's the moment that you can go? Because you can't go too early, can you? You can't go in half with half the information and some naysaying. So what's that feeling like? And also to get it to, because you may arrest these people, but then, of course, you got to make it stand up in court, and that can be a whole new kettle of fish.
Right. And in organized crime, when I do the investigation, I want to secure the evidence that facilitates the comfort with the prosecutor securing a conviction. And so in that capacity, federal prosecutors are usually a short window of time that they're there because they want to move on either to become a partner at a law firm or, you know, in some other capacity, politics or a judge. And so there's so many different agencies that work with them. You have DEA, ATF, IRS. So it's like you want to give them the evidence that they look at, appreciate, and said, I can do this. I can go forward with this. So the evidence can be documented evidence, recordings, in organized witnesses that, you know, are participants in the crime. So those are the types of things you try to secure for your indictment and your arrest. And the making recordings and maybe following it up with a search warrant where you're securing the evidence because you know that documents there are going to corroborate what was said on tape. And I mean, there's complexities when you're doing things. I mean, sometimes you're making recordings about somebody wanting to kill a guy, and you are not going to allow the murder to occur. So in one of the discussions in the book, you had a kid that was on drugs. He was just bipolar. He was out there, and he was the godson of Sammy Meatballs, Sammy Meatballs, last name Aparo. And he talked to Durso about wanting Durso to kill his godson because his godson was just out there. And I remember we sort of facilitated with other agents on my squad trying to get this kid back on his medications because he was off the medications. He was threatening the mother, the brother. He was very paranoid. And eventually, the murder was avoided because he got arrested by locals because he had another incident before the murder could occur. They put him into prison, and that was something that was avoided. But there was a bunch. I mean, Durso was supposed to be the individual that they used to kill a George Perone. George Perone was this historic figure with Vito Genovese, and Perone was an individual that made millions and millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for the Genovese family with his position with the Longshoremen's Association, the ILA, on the ports in New York, when it especially went from loading the ships manually to the containerization process. George facilitated the creation of a union that addressed the repairs of containers, repairs of the equipment, and it was just a huge moneymaker. And George was we hit it off because he said he didn't know he was Italian until he was 8 years old. We had Derso was supposed to, you know, be involved with the murder of George Perone. And George Perone, all he wanted, he went to prison for, I think, about 14 years rather than cooperate. And before going to prison, he facilitated, because of his close relationship with Chin Gigante, who at that time wasn't the boss. He was just, I think, a soldier, maybe a capo. And Chin Gigante asked George if he could facilitate a relationship with this individual, Bert Guido, Umberto Guido, who was an individual that did repair business for the containerization. And as I understand, Bert Guido had a relationship too, had a cousin in Genovese family. So that said, George goes to prison. Before he goes to prison, Bert Guido and him had some kind of relationship. I believe it was in a restaurant or something, and Bert owed George about 60 grand. Bert's making tens of millions of dollars. George comes out of prison, and Chin is now the boss, and Andrew, you know, is living a nice life, having to do nothing with Bert Guido other than breathe. And the guys that George facilitated jobs at the piers were making a great living. This Patty Falsetti, Tommy Cafaro. And now Bert Guido wants to get work down in Florida where George is living. And George has a relationship with Cubans down there doing very well. And all he wants is his 60 grand that's owed to him. And they find it would be insulting to ask Andrew Gigante or Bert Guido for the money owed to George because Chin's the boss. And I mean, the logic of that to me, having played sports as a teammate, you would do what's right. Just logical. If somebody cheap shot a guy in the field, you're going to look to get that guy, you know, because of the low blow he did and almost injured your player in a rugby match.
Yeah.
Say, I looked at this where I looked at the amount of money that George made, not only for the Genovese family, but specifically for Patty Falsetti, Tommy Cafaro, Andrew Gigante, Bert Guido. Why wouldn't you take it out of your own pocket and just give him the money? If you think you're insulting Chin, I mean, instead, they plan to use a guy to kill him. And I just, so when we took the case down, the proffer with George was comical because he was, you know, he killed numerous people, you know, for the West Side. But he was the type of guy that was a bright guy. He was in World War II. He was at Battle of Iwo Jima and other battles. And he was the type of guy that can describe, you know, flying out to say Michigan or wherever to negotiate union contract with shipping executives and then catch a plane and fly to Florida to kill a guy for Fat Tony Salerno. You know, it was fascinating, bright guy. The first day we were trying after the arrest to determine who's cooperating, who's not cooperating, George described how he grew up in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, which was a lot of Irish gangsters over the Westies. And George told me he didn't know he was Italian until he was 8 years old. We hit it off. I couldn't stop laughing. And I really joked with him after the fact about his stubbornness because he didn't back down. And I described that more of an Irish gene than
Having played rugby against London Irish, that is an Irish. That is definitely an Irish gene.
Well, they just beat England the other day.
Yes, let's not even go there. Now, now I could talk to you about this for the rest of the day, but I'm going to run out of time, Mike. So people are going to have to go and buy the book and find out what happened with the Oddfather for a start. Because I will be here. We'll be talking for the next hour if we even broach that one. Just a quick one. Just very, very quickly. A, did you ever fear for yourself? And B, how do you... You mentioned your wife watching Sopranos and stuff. How did she put up with you during this?
Well, there's some funny stuff. I mean, she did not want to hear about the frustrations I had at work because I had, you know, some... what I would describe as idiot bosses that just didn't understand the life. And you always have to get approvals for something when you're funding, say, a transaction. And... you know, a lot of times they were risk adverse, you know, how they're going to respond if something doesn't go the way, you know, that you're describing. And I'm thinking, you know, like, she didn't want to hear about my work. You know, she just, and I remember one time driving, I get a day, the kids are young, we're supposed to go to the beach. And I get a call from one of my sources who got shot. And I'm like, he's asking me, what do I do? I said, so you got shot? And it's, and I said, so go to the hospital. I can't go to the hospital because the police respond to shootings. So I'm like, you have a choice. You bleed out and die, or you go to the hospital, let the doctors address you, and then respond to the law enforcement that comes in an honest manner. But the, everybody in the car was sitting still like they couldn't believe it. And you can't make it up. So when I hang up, I had young kids, and they look like, is he so stupid? He got shot with a gun. It's just comical. That's, I mean, there are funny stories. When you're in that law enforcement capacity, they're just endless because you're dealing with, you know, spontaneously a lot of things similar to that. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's bank robberies. I was sitting in a van outside a social club in Little Italy because I wanted to put a wire in it. And it's Monday night. There's football. It's about 2 a.m. And these guys are talking about bank robbery as they're walking out of the social club, leaning against my van, talking about, we need a van like this. I've been in shootouts, all this type of stuff. And I'm just writing it because I need probable cause to install a bug. And these bank robbers eventually, I'd seen them again, another few weeks later, I parked my bureau car down by, you know, by a restaurant that Robert De Niro owns, my understanding. And as I'm walking to the corner, there's a bank, and I see these same guys, you know, two of them, eyeing an armored car that's making a bank delivery. And I'm thinking, is this the bank they're going to rob? And the guys there were affiliated with the Bonanno family, some of them. And so I went to the Bonanno squad, the squad that investigates them, because I do Genovese, and I told them who I saw, and they said, oh, they were, Jim Kossler, another agent, had made the similar observation, but there were other guys with him. So I thought, let me bring the photos from my investigation on Little Italy and see if he could pick out who the others were, and he picked out the guys that were leaning against the van. And we, I mean, there was a bunch of bank robbers that we ended up charging because they robbed the bank in, like, right by Rockefeller Center 2 days before Christmas.
Brilliant. Armored. Brilliant, brilliant stories. Mike, I'm going to run out of time. I'm really sorry. The book is called Mafia Takedown. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Go and get it. It's absolutely brilliant. Mike, if people want to find you, it's best to do it through the publishers, yeah?
Yeah, there's Skyline Publishing is the publisher of the book. They also published the book by Melania Trump. They pushed my book publishing date back 2 weeks because hers was being released, which I got a kick out of. But it's been a great opportunity working with them, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And also, there are quite a few YouTube videos, aren't there, as well? I think you've done quite a few things with the YouTube.
Yeah. I've been doing this regularly. I'm, you know, doing a Michael Francis one in a few weeks. So,
well, this
those
book-
who love organized crime, I hope they enjoy the book.
But they absolutely will. And honestly, I could talk to you for
a second. It'll be a sitcom someday.
It will, something like that. The book is called Mafia Takedown. It's by Mike Campy. Mike, it's been an absolute eye-opener and a pleasure to speak to you today.
Yep. Take care. Enjoy.